May it please the court, my name is Howard Becker. I represent Tom Miller, and we're before this court today on the appeal of a summary judgment. Tom Miller was struck by a train as he crossed a railroad track.
So what happened to him?
Physically? He was struck by a train, broke his...
Look, I know he's struck by a train. What happened to him as a result?
He broke his pelvis. He was in the hospital for 4 weeks. He lost consciousness. I went through a series of rehabilitation. He's back in the hospital with additional surgery and has permanent disabling injuries to his hip and to his arm. He did lose consciousness for about 4 weeks.
For about how long?
4 weeks.
4 weeks?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Just curious.
Suit was filed in Marion County and removed by defendant Amtrak. After discovery, the district court entered summary judgment in favor of the defendants and against the plaintiffs on two grounds. Number one, that the sole proximate cause of the accident was Tom Miller's failure to look and stop. And number two, that defendants CNIC, STS, and Central States owed no duty to Miller at all.
It seems to me, Mr. Becker, that we need to analyze these different defendants separately on this question of duty, because Illinois seems to have a fairly strict rule on control, thinking of STS and CSES, or I guess that's what I'll call them. They call themselves Central States, I guess. But as to that, I didn't see the kind of control of minutiae, I'll put it that way, that Illinois courts seem to look for. And if there's no duty, of course, it doesn't really matter what Mr. Miller was doing or not doing.
I agree with you, Judge. The test is really the sufficiency of control, and there has to be a retention of control so that the subcontractor is not free to do his job entirely free in his own way.
And what evidence is there in this record that Mr. Miller's company, or Mr. Miller is the subcontractor, was subject to that degree of control? It all sounds very generic to me, looking at these general conditions and looking at these various arrangements.
Under FRIS, which is the actual control doctrine, the Central States controlled the method by which S&M Basement went into the job site and left. Everything else was left to Central States. But when you think about a construction site and how trucks have to go in and out, Central States require them to use the very same crossing where the accident happened, in addition to that.
And where's the evidence that there... I guess I remember reading somewhere in this massive briefs that there are something like four different ways in and out, but people tended to use that east side over the three train track.
Is there a map in the record?
No, Joe.
There ought to be maps. Shouldn't there?
Yes.
Why don't you put maps? I don't understand. Very often cases turn very critically on some physical juxtaposition, you know, between parties and this and that. Here it's the tracks, the boxcars, how far the tracks apart, what kind of... All that is easily depicted in a map. I don't understand why lawyers insist on trying to reconstruct verbally what is much more easily grasped visually.
I understand, and I don't have an answer to that in this case.
Is the actual address of this place in the records? Is the kind of thing you could find on Google Maps or something?
It's an unincorporated area outside of Centralia, Illinois, called WAMAC, W-A-M-A-C. I don't believe the address is in the record.
But outside of Centralia, okay.
Yes, Judge. May I proceed with my answer
sure.
With regard to the control?
Please.
Not only did Central States require Miller to use this crossing, but this is the same crossing that they described in their site plan for the expected hazards to be railroad traffic over railroad crossing. Now, they wrote that, and also there's a judicial admission.
Well, what do you think they should have done? So you have a whole bunch of defendants, like the railroad and the Central States. So what should they have done to be properly careful?
The railroad, first of all, should have moved those cuts of cars. They were warned by Ellsworth on several occasions before the accident They're too close. I can't, by the time I get to the third track, I can't see that train. And Mr. Beer, who was their employee, said, the cars are moved routinely. That's why they're on the second and third track. So my point is, after Ellsworth warns them, I'm going to get killed on this if you don't move these.
Well, how long is the third track?
The third track goes from...
The track that the boxcars were parked on, how long is that?
I don't have that evidence.
Well,
but it's like very long. Does it go off the property?
Oh, it's hundreds of feet to the repair shop.
Hundreds of feet, yeah, but the boxcars occupy... The question is, how far can you move the boxcars, right? Is there some reason the boxcars are where they are rather than somewhere else? So it depends on the length of the track, right?
That is correct.
Why didn't you put in evidence about the length of the track?
I don't have an answer for that.
Put any evidence in. So, all right, move the boxcars. Now, what is it you'd want Central States to do?
Central States had the power to stop work. And
what would it mean, stop work? What are you talking about?
Well,
not do the job? I don't get you.
No, what I mean is, when the boxcars are that close to the same crossing you use every day and you can't see that third track, you say to either STS or the railroad, we're going to stop work because we've got to use this crossing.
Up to the previous question, is there some reason the boxcars are there and not a distance? So maybe the boxcars, suppose the boxcars have to be there, no other place for them. Then is there anything else Central States should have done to...
Yes.
What?
You can post a flag person. Because the railroad had a 5-minute warning before the train came on every single train. Now, if they're going to keep the boxcars so that people like Ellsworth can't see, then the least you can do is
now,
send somebody out there.
Now, you say can't see, but there are three tracks. So when you come out and you pass the boxcar, you've got the width of another track, which needless to say, you don't have any dimensions, but you have a width of another track to look in both directions, right?
Yes.
So if he just stopped at the boxcar line and then drove forward a few feet and looks to both sides, then he's safe, right?
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, that is a question of fact for the jury. We have enough.
Since you didn't put any evidence in about what the dimensions are, how do we know? He may have had. We don't even know how far the middle track is from the live track. So we don't know how much of a visual field he has when he emerges from behind the boxcars.
We know from the testimony of witnesses. I hate to keep going to Ellsworth, but Ellsworth had driven that track on several occasions and said, by the time I get to the third track, it's too late. I'm hung.
I understand you. There's an empty track in between. You. How far is his... So he's driving a truck?
Mr. Miller was driving a 4-ton pickup.
So how far is the cab of the truck behind the front of the truck?
I don't have evidence in the record to that.
You don't have anything. Suppose it's 3 feet. Okay, so then as he emerges from the boxcar... There's a 3-foot distance between the front of his truck and his cab. So is he 3 feet away from that, the third rail?
That's possible, but yes, that's possible.
Well, but if he's not, then if he stops after emerging from the boxcars and looks around, he'll see the train.
There is a wealth of evidence in the record that is true.
But, and that's what I wondered. Given that the second track doesn't seem to be a live track, if you will, it's not something that Amtrak trains are roaring up at 78 miles an hour, even if you were straddling the second track as you stopped to see if anybody was coming in the third track, would you be clear of the third track at that point?
Ostensibly, yes, but there's some suggestion that there could have been cars. There were cars on the outbound lead at some points. In fact, Chad Miller suggested that in the record that car was on the middle track. And if that...
Chad Smith?
I'm sorry.
Chad Smith, yeah. So there's some evidence in the record that there were obstructions on the second track as well?
There's one witness, yes. And I think from that, it's plausible for a jury to believe him and also believe Ellsworth and other people that said, due to the configuration, it was impossible to see the third track.
What configuration?
The configuration of...
curved these tracks?
No.
You mean by you don't really mean configuration so much as where the obstacles were placed.
Yes.
Where the boxcars
yes.
and other cars were.
Yes. In addition to that, there was evidence that there was boxcars on both sides, on obstructing north as well as south, so that a driver had to look left and right, which is the evidence we have that Tom Miller did in terms of his habit.
Do trains travel down that third track in both directions?
Yes. That's evidence from Dave Beer. Mm-hmm. He testified to that. In terms of the duty owed by the railroad, well, let me go back and talk about Central States.
In your brief, this person who said that the second track was obstructed?
He's mentioned in the brief, but I believe the reference to the record is not there, and but it is in the record. It's Chad Smith. Chats, it's Mike Miller, page 94 to 95 in appellant's supplemental appendix. And I don't have a line and page number, but it's on pages 94 to 95. He says it twice.
Okay, thank you.
In terms of the duty owed by the railroad, I think there should be an emphasis on foreseeability. And when you have Mr. Ellsworth...
Hasn't Illinois adopted the old... you know, Justice Holmes' rule, the Goodman rule of stop, look, and listen. You just have a duty, you know.
Yes.
You have to stop.
I agree, Your Honor.
And he didn't stop.
Well, there's some evidence.
If he'd stopped, he wouldn't have been hit.
I understand that reasoning, Your Honor, but there is evidence in the record that somebody trailing him saw his brake lights. And I think a reasonable inference is that when you see a brake light, somebody is putting their foot on the brake, and therefore he stopped.
Well, no. When you touch the brake light goes on. It doesn't mean you've stopped.
I understand that, but in light of the evidence...
Well, you don't stop in, you know, 1 inch. Yeah, it depends on your speed. It takes a while actually to stop.
I understand that, Your Honor, but in light of the evidence of habit that Mr. Miller automatically, when he came to a railroad track, stopped, slowed, looked left, looked right. I think a fair inference for a jury.
If he stopped and looked left and right, how could he have been hit? I don't get it.
That, I believe, is a question for the jury.
No, I don't understand the theory. I mean, you mentioned some obstruction, but I don't understand. If that second track, the middle track, is clear, and he stopped in front of the third track, right, then how could he have been hit?
If you look at the Rather testimony, he was the conductor operating the train, he said that he had 2 to 3 seconds between the time he first saw Mr. Miller and the time of the collision.
Is there any evidence in this record about the weather that day, about visibility?
Yes, visibility was not an issue.
So
and the sun was okay. Behind us. He was headed east.
Okay.
He had 2 to 3 seconds to see Mr. Miller and react. It follows, I think, by...
That proves nothing. All that proves is that Miller was on the track. The question is how, if he stopped, as he's supposed to, short of the live track, if he actually stopped, how could he have been hit? Okay, stopped. He stops, he looks, and then he'd see the train. The train isn't going the speed of light. How would he miss the train?
Well, there's evidence in the record that there was no warning sounded, so he didn't hear it before he got to the point where he could see. And there's a...
If you look, you see the train. It's a large object.
Yes, that's true, Your Honor, but I believe there's enough evidence in the record where other people were at the situation that would say that even if you did exercise due care and caution, like Ellsworth, by the time you got to the third track, you couldn't see it. Perhaps there was an obstruction on the middle track. But those are people who use the track every day. And I believe the district court... precluded the opportunity for Mr. Miller to submit this to a jury, weighed evidence, assign credibility, when that is particularly the realm of the fact finder, not the district court.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Becker. Mr. Kurtz?
May it please the court, my name is Mark Kurtz. On behalf of the railroads, Illinois Central Amtrak, and the train crew members, Judge Murphy had a tough job in front of him to find sole proximate cause as being a court question, a question for the court. And he went through an opinion that I think you will agree is eloquently written.
Well, it doesn't matter whether it's eloquently written. I mean, really.
He went through that opinion, and he refuted all evidence. He found that all the evidence supported only one cause of this accident, and that is the conduct of Mr. Miller, and you've been discussing that already this morning. Simply put, Mr. Miller's failure to stop and failure to look are the only cause of this accident. There is no other.
But there's evidence. I mean, what troubles me is several things. The Ellsworth testimony that even if you've done this, by the time you're that far, you've stopped and looked, you're too far along and you can't get out of the way of a train, Ellsworth trying to warn them that this is dangerous. And I'm also concerned about the obstruction, and there's a conflict in the testimony about whistles or not. You know, you've got Hall saying she does hear the collision, so it's not like she can't hear things, but she doesn't hear that. All of a sudden, this little sort of side dispute about whether anybody properly introduced into the record evidence from the black box or not. It seemed like some weighing of testimony was going on in a way that is not supposed to happen at the summary judgment stage.
Well, it's my feeling that Judge Murphy found that the only evidence put forward by the whistle witness Hall, or the negative whistle witness Hall, constituted only a scintilla of evidence of the whistle not sounding.
What does that mean?
Well,
she says I didn't hear it even though I could hear the collision. So she makes it clear she's in a position to hear.
We know
you can
there
call
are,
it a scintilla if you want, but I don't know why that's. What's a scintilla?
Well, a very small amount.
But
we know that there are five whistle witnesses who heard the whistle, one 400 yards north of the crossing when the train was approaching from the south. The engineer said he sounded it, and it's uncontroverted that the lights were flashing. And as I think this court is aware, when oscillating ditch lights flash on a locomotive, that means there's horn application. That means the horn is sounding. So that's what Judge Murphy, in my opinion, found, that the evidence on the whistle was overwhelming. People who live next to railroad tracks get used to it, and they don't hear every whistle. She may or may not have recalled hearing the whistle, but the people who were there that day, they heard the whistle. People following
so
the
So you're just basically saying we have to just weigh the evidence here, even though it's summary judgment.
I'm only saying because the evidence is so overwhelming that the whistle was sounded, that's why proximate cause was found here.
But
to be
we
only
have
on the
that argument made a lot. I mean, sometimes there'll be five witnesses who are all very credible-looking people, and one of them may be some paid government informant on the other side, and all kinds of reasons why you might not want to credit what that person says, but those cases go to juries.
Understood. And you make a great point, but the whistle witness is not enough here. There is no testimony that he stopped or that he looked, and as we all know,
what about his slowing down? I mean, there is testimony that he at least slowed down. The brake lights go on. We have to assume for the sake of argument at this stage that that's true. That's the standard for summary judgment.
True.
So we take the you know, the evidence in the record and the light most favorable to him. So the brake lights go on.
Yes, one of the four people said the brake lights were applied.
Right, right. And so that maybe he slows down enough.
But four witnesses, and none to the contrary.
Don't count witnesses.
All right. Several
witnesses. You have to live with that fact if you're going to support a summary judgment.
All right. I understand that. Even if he slowed, he didn't look. There is no testimony that he looked until he was on the track, the live track.
Well, how does anybody know that? Who's inside the cab with him? No one, right? He's alone in the car, and there are three people in the pickup. Three people in the pickup behind him.
True. The reasoning for that comes from the fact that Tom Rathert, the engineer of the Amtrak locomotive, could actually see the person driving, and the person never looked at him the whole time.
I find that not terribly persuasive. The train is going 78 miles an hour, and this engineer, I mean, you can do the math and figure out how quickly it's approaching that crossing. And this engineer, who apparently has eagle eyes, you know, can see into the cab of a truck that's approaching this and see which way, you know, if it makes eye contact with the man, that's just too much. I mean,
that's what Mr. Rathert said, and it's uncontroverted. I understand your concerns about that testimony, but that is what he says. We know that the
I thought your argument was simply that if you look at the arrangement of the objects and so on, there isn't any way in which he could have come to a full stop after the boxcars and looked and yet been hit. Isn't that your point? Right?
Yeah, there is no.
If he stopped, then if he'd stopped, he would have seen the train. And
he stopped, he sees the train, and he can't be hit. Because I don't believe there's evidence of boxcars on the second track. That's not what it was used for. That was for switching trains in and out. These were parked boxcars on the inside track. There is obviously space between the tracks, and I believe Your Honor is correct. A map would have been a nice remedy for you folks to have, and I apologize for that. But there is distance between tracks. His partner, Smith, says, yes, you can creep out over these tracks, and anybody crossing three sets of railroad tracks goes slow. We all know that. You're going to bottom your car out or your truck out if you don't.
But I found Smith's testimony much more ambiguous than you made it out to be. If you go back and look at it, I don't know whether it was you or one of your co-counsels, but defense counsel keeps asking, you know, once you've stopped and looked both ways, can you see pretty far down? And the answer from Smith, if you got out onto the track after you got by them cars, he says, and then over and over again, the question is asked, if you wanted to go, here's the last one, if you wanted to go over the tracks slow enough and stop after you went past the first set of tracks, this is a question all from defense counsel, would there be enough room, essentially? Smith replies, I don't know. I don't think you could, me personally. So I don't think Smith is saying, oh, sure, you know, as soon as you go out past the boxcar track, if you will, you're fine.
You're referring to Gary Smith, I tell you. There are multiple Smiths and Millers in this case.
This is Chad Smith.
Oh, Chad Smith. I'm referring to Gary, his business partner. I agree.
Well, Chad Smith has this testimony. Again, you know, it's summary judgment. If we have some testimony, we have to assume a jury would find. You have to assume the jury's going to find everything in favor of the opponent, and nonetheless he loses. You know,
Understood. Let me conclude with this. Even if Mr. Smith is correct and there is an obstruction doesn't matter if the motorist doesn't look. There could have been a 20-foot wall there. If he's got blinders on and never looks to the right, what does it matter what's there? It can't be causal. The only thing that caused this was, sadly, the unfortunate fact that he didn't look.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kerrs. Mr. Keffel, Refeld?
May it please the Court. I represent the Appley STS acquisitions. I plan on spending most of my time talking about the issue of duty in Section 414 of the restatement. But before I do that, I want to address the issue. Your Honor had mentioned there's no map in the record, and there's not. But there is some testimony of how much space there is between the sets of tracks. And it comes from Chad Smith, the gentleman who you were just referring to. And he placed the distance between the sets of tracks is 10 feet each. So I don't know how wide a set of tracks is, but there's at least 20 feet plus the width of the middle track between the edge of the track, the first track on which those boxcars were placed, and the edge of the mainline track on which the train was traveling. There's also some testimony in the record that says you can go past the first line of boxcars and stop before you get to the middle track. And that's the point where you have a clear view in both directions of the main line.
See, the odd thing is that the greater the width, actually the weaker your case, because this is the weakness of the Goodman rule. I mean, because you get past the first boxcars. Now you have to make a judgment. Are you going to make sort of a rush for it, right? It's 20 feet plus the width of the middle track, plus the width of the third. To get clear, you have to go 20 feet plus two track widths, right? You have to cross the middle track. You have to cross the live track in order to be safe, right, to avoid being hit. So it's like 30 feet, probably.
Right. You'd have stopped after you got past the first track.
You stop right after the boxcars, and then you make your run for it. The 30 feet.
Well, it wouldn't be 30.
There's always, of course, a danger. If you have to go 30 feet to be safe, well, what if in the course of that 30 feet the train first appears and hits, right? Then you're trapped.
I don't think it'd be straight,
of course, if the tracks are straight for a long time and so on.
It wouldn't be quite that far, though. I think the testimony in the record showed that between the spot where people stopped after the first set of tracks and the main line was about 15 to 16 feet.
Now look, you said there are 10 feet between tracks. That means so the boxcars...
Tracks, yes.
Right. The boxcars are on one set, 10 feet to the middle track,
right.
10 feet to the live track. So you have to cross 20 feet plus the width of those two tracks. In order to be safe, right?
You do, but not all at one time.
Oh, wait a sec. What?
How many times are you supposed to stop?
Would drive past the first set of tracks and stop. And so
That's what Judge Posner's assuming. You'd go past the first set of tracks. You're clear of the boxcars. You stop.
Stop.
You look down to the south. You look up to the north, since things can go either way, as we're told. And now you go. But in the meantime, these trains are zooming along, you know, at more than a mile a minute. And if you've stopped too soon, you have 30 feet to go, the train can materialize in a very short amount of time, possibly seconds.
Well, there's testimony that shows that at that point, these tracks, the main line, all three of them for that matter, are straight. There's no curves or anything. So you can see, and a number of witnesses testified, you could see all the way to the horizon. So the train would have to... In order for the train to appear, there's no evidence of how fast it would have to be, but it would have to be.
It is the smaller. Farther away it is, the smaller. No, I think you're probably right. The question is, I mean, do we have the degree of confidence? I mean, the test is, if this case went to a jury and they found in favor of Miller, would the judge have to throw it out, grant judgment for the defendants on the theory that it was just too fantastic? That's your contention, right?
Yes, it is. It is. Well, my time is up. I didn't get a chance to go to the duty
argument.
Well,
take a minute and make your point about duty.
Well, the only thing I want to talk about on duty is STS, my client, retained the Central States, the subcontractor beneath us, and Central States in turn retained the plaintiff's company. So the relationship between us and Central States is employer-independent contractor. If we're to have a duty at all in this case, it has to be under Section 414 of the Restatement. And that section requires, in order for the employer, my client, to have a duty, they have to have exercised and retained some control over the work. Your Honor,
I guess the question is really what work. When Mr. Becker was responding to that, he was essentially making the argument that the duty extends only to those matters over which you have retained control. So even if, let's suppose Mr. Miller had been injured while he was working on the job site during the course of the day, you didn't retain any control over that, at least as 414 would understand that term. Therefore, no liability, easy, no duty. But he argues there is one little thing you did retain control over, and that was the egress, entry-egress path. And so since you did retain control over that, you did have a duty over that. That's my understanding, anyway, of his argument.
I don't believe we did retain control. I don't think we ever had control of the crossing itself. That the crossing was not.
Well, but instructed them that this was the way they were to go? You dictated their activity to this extent. That's as I understand. That's the allegation.
The plaintiff testified that nobody instructed them where to go.
So how else were they supposed to leave?
This was by far the most convenient of the access points to get to this particular job site, and everybody was using it. But there were three. I believe there were three other routes that could have been, none of them convenient, but three other routes that could have been used to get to and from this particular job site.
Okay.
I'm eating up too much of counsel's time.
Thank you, Mr. Raphael. Mr. Crawford?
May it please the Court, I'm Tom Crawford, representing Central States Environmental Services. If I could just address some of the questions that were posed to my co-counsel. There were three other entrances, and in fact, it's not in the briefs, but it was in the record below, that they in fact did use on several occasions some of the other exits or entrances, means of ingress and egress, because there were trains crossing on that main entrance that they were using, and even though it was somewhat inconvenient, they did use those because they need to get to lunch.
Who's they?
The workers, S&M workers. With respect to the distance question that was posed of, isn't the fact that the greater the distance between the tracks, more of a, negative for the defendants than a positive, I would disagree with that. Certainly the more distance you have between the tracks, unless there is a complete wall.
No, but look, you're going across, you're going across tracks. You would hesitate to stop straddling the middle track, because it is in use, right? You don't want to stop there. But on the other hand, if you don't stop, then you know you're committed, you're going forward, and the more distance you have to traverse, the greater the risk that you'll be hit by a train.
Certainly, if you did not stop and look.
No, you don't understand. I mean, suppose very often, if you cross a railroad yard, you might cross a dozen tracks.
Right.
You don't want to stop on each of the tracks so you can look and see whether something's happening on the track in front of you, because no one wants to be parked on a track, right? That's very dangerous.
Certainly.
Right. That's the dilemma of a stop, look, and listen rule.
Certainly. And if a driver were to use your strategy of get past the first track and then just make a mad dash for it without ever having experienced that set of tracks, that to me would seem to be very dangerous.
Yes, but his alternative would require him to stop on the second track, which is also a track in use, right?
Correct. But once you got past that first track, where the boxcars were sitting. And again, there's no evidence in the record as to how far down they were.
No, you don't understand. You get past the boxcars, you look around, and then you have a choice. Either streak across the two tracks, or you go to the second track, the middle track, and you stop so you can look to see what's happening with the third track. But while you're stopped on the middle track, you're vulnerable to something happening on the middle track, right?
I would respectfully disagree that those are the only two options.
Okay, what's the third option?
Third option, and I think there are more than three options, but the third option is you cross the first set of tracks, you're creeping at a very slow rate of speed, and as you are crossing, you are looking at least in one of the directions. And here there's no evidence that he looked in any direction. What he did is he was going at a fairly slow speed. He did not make a mad dash, even
so
though...
Why wasn't he doing what you recommend? He was creeping.
I couldn't tell you why he wasn't looking, but I don't know if he was creeping. The rate of speed that has been estimated at about 10 miles per hour, whether that's creeping or not, I don't think it's material, but he was going fairly slow. The thing is, he has traveled this crossing for at least 10 days. He'd been there on the job site for a week and a half. He told his employees, watch out, this is dangerous. He knew it was dangerous. He told his employees it was dangerous, not just once, but on several occasions. And so, and the witnesses that have testified, and even Tommy Miller testified, this train comes by at 5 every day. They knew that, give or take a few minutes, this train came by at the time they...
Does the Illinois statute eliminate... does... Does it eliminate comparative negligence? I mean, does it say that if you violate the statute, you don't use due care and caution and so on, and you don't? Does that mean that even if the railroad or contractors, what have you, are negligent, you can't recover anything? Is that?
I'm sorry.
Suppose you violate, you're the driver, you violate the statute, this obedience to signal indicating approach of train. But suppose the defendants are negligent. Does that mean you have no claim, or does it just mean your damages are cut down?
Well, I think it depends on the percentage of negligence.
So, in other words, the ordinary rule in Illinois applies here. Ordinarily in Illinois,
right.
It's a comparative negligence
right.
jurisdiction, and there's nothing special about this statute that uses the old common law contributory negligence of any amount as an absolute bar rule.
Right, right.
Okay.
But I would say, though, that...
You know, all this sole proximate cause stuff, I mean, clearly... all of the parties could have avoided the accident, maybe very inefficiently. The train could have crept along at 5 miles an hour. The boxcars could have been moved or fitted with mirrors or something like that. Or they could have closed this crossing and used the inconvenient crossing. So suppose the failure to take those precautions was negligent, and he was also negligent. That wouldn't necessarily... destroy his case, it might just reduce his damages.
Certainly, but that would require some finding.
I don't know how causation comes into this, right?
Well,
I don't understand all the discussion of how he's the sole proximate cause. What's that about?
Well,
just legal gibberish.
The trial court never got to the issue of whether there was negligence on the part.
Yes, I know. What is this sole proximate cause? Business. What is
well,
that?
I believe that the trial court was saying that had he stopped and looked, he would not have...
Of course, that's true whenever there's contributory negligence.
And
if you'd been careful, you would have avoided the accident. But it's no longer a complete defense, only a partial defense.
Unless...
What is special about this case?
But there was no evidence.
As you say, the court didn't get to the issue of the negligence of these defendants. But is that proper?
But there was no evidence at this point of any negligence on the part of the other defendants. And the court,
well, the simplest court, example would be, you know, you say, or your other lawyer said, this was a dangerous crossing. Well, it could have been closed, and they could have forced the subcontractors to use the inconvenient crossing. Now, you could argue, well, if it's sufficiently dangerous, then it was negligent to leave this crossing open. So if one of the defendants or one or more of the defendants was negligent and he was negligent, then why does it eliminate his case rather than just reducing the amount of damages he could recover?
Because, and I'm, you know, without trying to speculate as to how the judge reached his decision, the decision states that there was only one possible reasonable inference based on all the facts that...
No, you don't understand. That's not the issue. One possibility is they could have closed the crossing, right?
Correct.
And maybe their failure to do that was negligent, an issue he didn't get to. But if one of the defendants was negligent and Miller was negligent, why does that wipe out his claim?
Well, you're basing your question on some assumptions that have not been proven or even...
But you said the judge didn't reach the issue of negligence. Apparently he stopped short because he had some notion about sole proximate cause. I'm just asking what that means.
Well, he determined, or at least my understanding of what he determined, is that there...
You have your own understanding of what sole proximate cause
there
means?
There is only one possible reasonable, not just a possible inference, but a reasonable inference, objectively, that people would reach was the cause, in this case, of this accident.
But, you know, maybe the problem with this analysis is it assumes that the correct starting point of time is the moment when Mr. Miller has pulled his car out beyond the boxcars. And some of these other theories of negligence, maybe another reason the accident happens, that that crossing is open at all. It's certainly a but-for cause, right? Maybe another reason is that there was no flag person there signaling to people, don't cross right now. We've gotten word that the train is coming in 5 minutes. You know, it depends when you start your inquiry, and if the judge never looked at these other possibilities, maybe that was a mistake.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and I don't believe the judge made a mistake. I mean, certainly you can put a flagman there, you can have crossing guards, you can have lights, you can do all kinds of things. This was a private crossing. The question is, I believe, is what would have been the cost? I mean, to do this at every private crossing.
Private crossing, but of course it's not just being crossed by employees of the workers of the railroad, it's being crossed by strangers, right? They have a duty of care to them, their invitees. So, I mean, you, not you. I mean, the railroad has a duty of care. So, anyway, we understand your argument. Thank you. So, Mr. Becker, does he have any more time? 1 minute? Anything further?
I have one point, and I just want to clarify a question Judge Wood asked. The entity that instructed Mr. Miller on which crossing to use was Central States, not STS, and that's on page 80 of the record. STS acquiesced in that instruction, and there, from pages 54 to 58, there's testimony in that regard. That's
okay, thank you. Thank you very much.